I invite you to study with us this morning as we look further at the Sermon on the Mount. So if you'd open a New Testament to Matthew chapter 5, page 651 in the Pew Bible. Matthew chapter 5. We're going to study from the latter part of this chapter this morning. As we begin, I want to draw your attention to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 20. Jesus said, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." In the latter part of chapter 5, as Jesus is in the middle of his exposition here, he's contrasting what the common religious thinking of the day was with the deeper significance of what God intended in the law. The Pharisees had fallen into moral pollution under the cover of religious orthodoxy. They fancied themselves to be adhering to the will of God and to respect the law of God. But as Jesus is pointing out in various ones of these comparisons, "You've heard that it was said, but I say unto you." What he's doing is revealing the unrighteousness of the Pharisees, even as they were dressed in their religious robes. They had so twisted and corrupted the law so as to allow them to follow their own inclinations and really circumvent the teaching of the law, either by their traditions or simply by ignoring plainly what the law taught and on a technicality doing something else. And so what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount is he's trying to bring people back to the heart of righteousness, and that is our attitudes and our motives. And so in this part of the sermon, we mentioned the fact that we tend to get a little bit taken with this sermon from an idealistic point of view. Oh, this is wonderful. The Son of God's teaching these wonderful, sublime truths. Wouldn't it be nice to be sitting there in the meadow and listening to Jesus expound upon the law till we really begin to make application of the law? And we feel the sting of Jesus piercing into our heart and basically saying, "What kind of a heart do you have?" And so Jesus has already addressed anger as the root of murder. That's in verses 21 through 26. "You've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder." And the Pharisees were focusing on just simply not killing somebody. But they absolutely despised their fellow man and were filled up with hatred, not realizing that it's the hatred that gives rise to the murder. It's the attitude that gives rise to the action. Then in verses 27 and following, Jesus exposed lust as being the underlying cause of adultery. It's not just withholding yourself from the act of adultery. But he said, when you set your mind and your heart on obtaining someone that you have no right to, you've essentially already committed the act in your heart, in your thinking, in your intentions. All you lack now is an opportunity to carry through with that. So he focuses on the heart, again, relative to lust. And we said last week, these are two of the great scourges on the earth: murder and adultery, murder and sexual unfaithfulness. The literal killing of somebody and the figurative killing of somebody, if you will. Because to commit adultery against my mate is to kill them. It is to just destroy them emotionally and to reject them and to basically dehumanize them. And Jesus is warning us not to do that. "You've heard that it was said," verse 31, "whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery." Hold a finger here and turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 24. That's page 139 in the Pew Bible. There's so little said in the law of Moses about divorce. What is said clearly in the law toward the end of Old Testament revelation in Malachi is God hates it. God hates divorce because of the nature of what it is. It is the emotional murdering of someone. It is the infliction of pain and anguish on spouse and children and extended members of the family. It's injecting confusion as to how relationships should be looked at from that point on. It's a horrendous thing to be unfaithful against a mate and ultimately to put them away in divorce. And so in Deuteronomy chapter 24, here's just the very smallest shred almost of what God directly says about divorce in the law of Moses. When a man takes his wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, when she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord. And you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. I think this is something akin to the idea of let the accuser cast the first stone. You better be awfully sure when you are the one to instigate the execution. You better be sure of the guilt. And where the stress is in Deuteronomy 24 is not the cause for putting away. And it seems like Moses is already seeing divorce among the people of God, and he's trying to corral it. He's trying to control it. And what he's saying to the people, and you see where the emphasis is just in the reading, it's not the cause, it's the consequence. If you put her away and she becomes the wife of someone else, you cannot take her back, even if her second husband dies. And so it seems like what Moses is really trying to get at is you better be sure before you engage in this thing which God hates in the first place. You better be sure of what you're doing, because you're forever cutting off this mate. You're cutting yourself off from reconciliation if she then remarries. And so it seems that in Deuteronomy 24, the purpose of Moses was to govern unbridled treachery against wives. In fact, in Matthew 19 and verse 8, when this question comes up of divorcing and remarrying and the causes, Jesus responds to them about the allowance of Moses for divorce. It was because of the hardness of your hearts that God, through Moses, permitted this to be so. It's because of their spiritual destitution and their lack of deep understanding of relationship and desire to promote and to preserve that relationship. God allowed that to be, but He never approved of it as something that fit His initial design for marriage and the one man and one woman for life concept that arises from creation. The writing of divorce that Moses gave was to keep the man from acting hastily and putting his wife away. But yet the Pharisees had taken that and twisted the intent of the law and tried to figure out every which way they could, how they could get out of a marriage they weren't happy with. And so again, you see what the Pharisees are doing with the law. Instead of trying to get at the spirit and the intent of the law and keep it in their hearts, they're looking for loopholes. They're looking for ways around it. And so there were different schools of thought in the first century among the Jews, the school of Hillel, the school of Shammai, and others who would argue back and forth as to what all of the different causes for divorce were. But it's apparent that the Pharisees, by the nature of their questions and their practice, had followed after the teaching of Hillel, who was a great Jewish rabbi of the day, who taught that there were a multitude of reasons that fell under uncleanness in Deuteronomy 24. A multitude of reasons for which you could just capriciously cast aside your wife and marry somebody else. And so what Jesus is doing is trying to refocus the minds of these people back on the significance of marriage and the consequence of divorce. He says in verse 32, "But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality," and watch where he puts the emphasis here, "causes her to commit adultery." Jesus is dealing in this section with treachery done from one against another. He began with murder. And then he talked about lusting, breaking forth in unfaithfulness, adultery. Now he's talking about the injury you create in someone else's life, deep spiritual injury, by causing them to commit adultery, remarriage assumed. And shouldn't Jesus assume remarriage? Isn't that what normally happens after people divorce? I mean, you think about it yourself in your own acquaintances. How many people do you know of that divorce and do not remarry? Would you not say the greater majority remarry? And so from that, there's a general principle. If you put away your mate for a reason other than the one God stipulated that's valid in putting a mate away, and that's sexual misconduct, adultery, you put away your mate for a frivolous reason. When they remarry, you're a party to their adultery. That's what Jesus says. "I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery." Let's just drop the condition for a minute and read it. And I think you'll see the import more clearly. "But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife causes her to commit adultery." That's what he's saying. You're behaving treacherously again, and you're doing it by circumventing Deuteronomy 24. You're interpreting Deuteronomy 24 in such a way to create license to divorce. And what Jesus is saying is that's not what Moses intended when he wrote that. He intended to curtail it by saying, if you do this, you can't have her back if she remarries. So while Moses is putting restrictions on divorce, the Pharisees looked at it for license. Let me see how many different ways I can get out of my marriage. You see, they're doing the same thing with that teaching that they've done with you shall not murder and you shall not commit adultery. And what Jesus, I think, is additionally saying here is adultery does not happen merely on the basis of lust, which is what he was saying earlier, verses 27 and following. "You've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has committed adultery already in his heart." He's taking this a step further. You don't even have to necessarily fall into lust. You just might dislike your mate so much that you want out of the marriage, and you get out of the marriage on some technicality that God doesn't approve of, and he said, you know what? You're creating adultery. When your put-away spouse remarries, you're creating adultery. And not only that, look at the last part of 32. "Whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery." This is not politically correct teaching in that day or ours. This is very strict and it's very rigid. And the reason is we all have two eyes. We can look around in our society and see what divorce and remarriage and divorce and remarriage and divorce and remarriage. You can see what that does. Open your eyes and look around. Before we start throwing rocks at the backward morality of the Bible, check out our morality. Take a good hard look at our standards of divorcing and remarrying and ask yourself how good that is for the children and the innocent spouse, and society at large. Jesus is strict on this because he knows the damage that comes when selfish people start breaking their vows, which we'll talk about in a minute, and then remarrying multiple times. And again, we've got children confused about who their real mom or dad are and when they can spend time with which one, and when they do, what's the role going to be? When they're with the parent they see only occasionally. And what about this new kid in my house now that I've never met before or didn't know well? How do I look at him? How do I look at her? Step brothers and sisters. It's a mess. It's a mess. And I tell you, the way you stop creating that kind of a mess is you start going back to the heart and you start going back to God's will and you start going back to the intent of marriage and the sense of honor and character and integrity that you bring into that relationship which God designs to be for life. That's how you honor what Jesus is trying to drive at here in Matthew chapter 5. But I don't think the intention here, and we would have to explore further other passages, including Matthew 19. I don't think the intention of Jesus here is to give us a full exposition of divorce and remarriage. What He's trying to do is contrast how the Pharisees had been interpreting law and how it's just gutted the morality of the people with really what the higher standard is that Jesus is coming to reinstitute. And here's part of it. I say to you, the only reason that someone can put away their mate and remarry another and it not be adultery is if they put their mate away for sexual unfaithfulness. It's a high standard. In fact, the disciples will later say, it's better for a man not to marry if that's the case. That's the way people react when privileges are taken away. Or what they see as privileges are taken away. Well, it's just better not even to do it. And Jesus said, well, that's not very realistic, is it? How many people can live a celibate life? So Jesus is cutting through the faulty exposition of the Pharisees. He's cutting through the technicalities that are nothing more than loopholes for them to get around and do what God hates. I hate putting away. And Jesus said it's only to be done in the strictest of circumstances. Now, let's talk about the making of oaths. We've already read these in our reading this morning, so I'll not belabor them again. But in verses 33 through 37... I think what's happening here is Jesus is now attacking, in the conventional wisdom of that day, He's now attacking another loophole that the Pharisees had been placing forth. They didn't put a whole lot of stock in their personal honor and keeping their word, but when they vowed to do something, the degree of their responsibility, their obligation to keep that vow, depended on what it was they swore on. And you'll see Jesus mentions here, don't swear by heaven, verse 34, nor by the earth, 35, Jerusalem in 35, don't swear by your head. And in fact, hold a finger there, go to Matthew 23, you can see this a little bit more, and what He says when He vehemently expresses woes upon the Pharisees, Matthew 23, verses 16 through 22. Speaking to the Pharisees, woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he's obliged to perform it. Is that not completely silly? They're swearing on different things in order to give themselves a way out if they change their mind. So, you know, if I swear on the temple... Well, that may be somewhat significant, but, you know, don't hold me too tightly to that. But by the gold of the temple, that's another thing. Swear by the gold of the temple. Fools and blind, verse 17. Which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? Look what they're doing. They're taking the material thing off the temple and counting that to be more important than the temple itself, which represents relationship with God. Oh yeah, that thing that represents my relationship with God, you know, when I swear on that, it doesn't count. It's like having my fingers crossed behind my... Oh, I only swore on the temple. Is this not just silly thinking about it? Surely we wouldn't do anything like that, would we? Surely we wouldn't give our word about something and leave ourselves an out, maybe without actually saying so. Whoever swears, verse 18, by the altar, it's nothing. Whoever swears by the gift that's on it, he's obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift on the altar? The gift, or the altar that sanctifies the gift. Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. He who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it. You see what Jesus is saying here? So when we go back to Matthew chapter 5, and He says, I say to you, do not swear at all. And then He gives these examples of their loophole swearing. He says in verse 37, let your yes be yes and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Again, I think he's getting back to the heart of the issue, and that's your integrity. There should be no difference within my heart if I say to you, I'm going to do this. And if I say to you, on the Word of God, I'm going to do this. To me, it should make no difference. Because it's an issue of the heart. It's an issue of personal honor. If you ask me, Jim, will you do this for me? And I say, yes, I've obligated myself. Based on my honor and my character and my intent and my concern for you, I've obligated myself to do what I said I would do with one word, yes. Does it make a difference if I swear on the Bible? Does it make a difference if I swear on the temple or I swear on the gold of the temple? That I create some false gradations and say, well, you know, if I swear by that, I really need to try to do that. But if I swear by this thing down here, well, it's not that important. Again, Jesus is driving into the heart, piercing deeply into the heart and saying, what kind of a person are you? Not do you look at either the Scriptures or the items of God as being of varying importance so you can swear on one thing and swear on another, but act differently regarding that. I'm not going to go into this in depth. The thing that usually comes out of this is, well, if I testify in a court of law, is it wrong to swear on the Bible? You know, I do think that we have examples in the New Testament where even Paul calls God to witness to what he's saying. I don't think the issue is necessarily swearing in a court of law. I think the issue is what's in my heart and what's my intent. Is my intent to tell the truth? I think there are times in life where because of the dishonesty among human beings, and in the case of a court of law because of perjury, which is not uncommon, we're being put in a position to give affirmation to someone else that what I'm saying to you, I'm saying in solemn truth. The affirmation, or in that case, whether it's swearing on the Bible in the court of law, or you just simply say, which I've done on occasion before, I've simply asked the judge if I could forego swearing on the Bible and simply affirm that I would tell the truth, and the court will usually accommodate that. But nonetheless, that type of assurance is for the jury and what they see in me. It doesn't change my obligation. Whether I affirm or whether I put my hand on the Bible, or whether I just say, yes, I will tell the truth, I'm obligated in either case. In any case, I'm obligated to tell the truth. And not be like the Pharisees and start looking for ways to justify lying. And so I think Jesus really doesn't have in mind what we do in court and a formal declaration or notarizing something. Shouldn't I just be able to fill out the form without notarizing it? Yes, but by law, you know, it needs to be notarized in some cases to show that this writing and this signing was legitimate and accurate. Jesus is driving at the heart. Do you want to tell the truth? Really is what he's saying. Do you want to tell the truth? Is that what's in your heart? By the way, it should go without saying, this applies to marriage. There is no crossing your fingers behind your back when you say, I do. And he's still driving, I think, at some of these issues that have just corrupted the Jewish people in his day. Murder and hatred, being at each other's throats, committing adultery and justifying it, putting your mates away for burning the toast, as it were, and just for not keeping covenants in general. He's piercing through to these people's hearts and revealing to them what really is there. You've heard that it was said in verse 38, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak also. Whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, I'll just refer to that. The law said, you shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. The law of Moses was a different kind of a system to live under. That's certainly true. People were actually commanded by God to kill others to carry out the will of God. But God never enjoined or encouraged or accepted hatred. And He expected people to make that distinction. And He expected judicial rightness to be done. But He did not allow for the innocent party to just be swallowed up with vengeance so they could get a pound of flesh, as it were, out of those who had done them wrong. When we talk about this statement, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, that's so often said in our day and time in terms of wanting to get even with somebody. But, you know, there's a couple of problems with that. Number one is we rarely want to get even when we feel that way. We want to get past even. And I think that's the point, really. And if we can turn to Leviticus 24, that's page 87 in the Pew Bible. Leviticus 24, 17 through 20. I think if we begin to look more closely into the law of Moses, what you see relative to justice, and I mean justice among men, judicial rightness, you see that the law is concerned about repaying wrongs done in an equal fashion. You don't see any of this, you kill my dog, I'm going to kill your firstborn. Because that's the human tendency. You kill my dog, I'm going to kill your child. We can get real attached to things. And we can get swallowed up in vengeance and hatred and bitterness. And so what happens from that kind of a mindset is we overreact. Vigilante justice is often an overreaction. And the law of Moses is trying to prevent that. There were certain penalties depending on the injury that was done. Leviticus 24, verses 17 and following. Whoever kills any man shall surely be put to death, but whoever kills an animal shall make it good animal for animal. You see, it's not human for animal. If a man causes disfigurement to his neighbor, and as he has done, so it shall be done to him, fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, as he has caused disfigurement of a man, so shall it be done to him. And that sounds barbaric. You know, I put out your eye, you put out my eye. What he's trying to say is, if I end up putting your eye out, I'm not to have my head cut off. There's balance, judicial restraint and balance in this. An eye for an eye does not mean get him back. It means redress it in an equal way. And whoever kills an animal shall restore it, verse 21, but whoever kills a man shall be put to death. Because there is a difference between an animal and a man. If I kill your dog, you ought not to kill me. Even if I had no right to kill your dog. There's a difference between a man's life and a dog's life. And the law of Moses acknowledges that. It also acknowledges that it's right to take a human life for murder. Verse 22, you shall have the same law for the stranger and one from your own country, for I am the Lord your God. Then Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and they took outside the camp him who had cursed and stoned him with stones, and the children of Israel did as the Lord commanded Moses. It's all in the context of a real life case. And they're examining what to do and how much justice to mete out based on what the law taught. What Jesus, I think, is saying in these verses, 38 through 42, back in Matthew 5, we should not be motivated by vengeance, by retribution, or by anger. Somebody's got to stop the cycle of violence. And God says to His people, it's going to be us. It's going to be you. When you are wronged, I'm putting the onus on you to stop the cycle of violence. You should not fall into hatred. You should not fall into bitterness. You should not take justice into your own hands. You should not do what the Pharisees were doing, and that was looking for a loophole in an eye for an eye, and indulging in bitterness. Somebody made this observation. If revenge slumbers in our breast, little injuries will waken it as quickly as big ones. If I'm bitter, I'm going to exaggerate everything done to me. In a smaller case, you know, if I'm walking around with a chip on my shoulder, I'm going to interpret everything said to me as being an insult. I'm going to take it personally. And then I'm probably going to overreact to it. That's why vigilante justice often goes beyond the pale. It goes beyond justice into simply venting one's spleen because it makes me feel better. Now, these words of Jesus have created a lot of controversy. Do we look at them literally and unconditionally? Turn the other cheek. Do not resist him who is evil. Do not resist the evil person. If somebody wants to sue me and take one thing, should I give him everything, lock, stock, and barrel? I mean, is that really the emphasis of what Jesus is saying? If so, let's just grant we should take Jesus absolutely, completely, literally here. And he says in verse 39, I tell you not to resist an evil person. I don't mean to be silly, but do you have locks on your house? Do you have an alarm system? Do you have bars over the windows? Do you have fence around your yard? Do you have insurance? Would you exercise self-defense in any capacity? I mean, what is Jesus saying here? Is he saying for me to leave my doors open so that if the evil man comes, I should not resist him? I should let evil have its way with me. Is that what he's saying? I mean, it sounds like it if you're going to look at it word for word and take him literally and without any condition whatsoever. There's a problem, though, that I think arises in that kind of an understanding of what Jesus is saying, and that is even Jesus and even an example of Paul, we find them not always giving place to the evil one. Paul used legal privilege. He used his right of Roman citizenship to escape punishment. Jesus rebuked the man who slapped him during the trial, tried to make him see more deeply into what he was doing. When Paul and Silas were imprisoned in Philippi and the magistrates were going to let them go in private, Paul said, you send them here. We're staying right here till they come personally and let us out. The idea of fleeing, Jesus fled. Jesus fled Nazareth when the crowd came in upon him at the synagogue and wanted to throw him off the cliff. Did he resist? He went his way, apparently in some miraculous way, from the crowd and was able to escape. It seems to me, and you do your own thinking investigating on this, but it seems to me Jesus is doing what he normally does in his teaching, and he goes to an extreme to demonstrate a particular point, especially a point that was being indulged in, engaged in by the Pharisees of his own day. What he's trying to say is, don't let yourself be drawn into treachery, especially under the pretense that you deserve, which we hear so much of today, to have your way. You deserve to pay that guy back. You deserve it because of what... No, Jesus said, look, you need to be careful that you don't get drawn into tit for tat, eye for eye, exacting your own vengeance behavior. Somebody might say, now wait a minute, you're just trying to get around exactly what Jesus said. I mean, he says, turn the other cheek. Well, back in verses 29 and 30, Jesus said, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you, for it's more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. That's exactly what he said. Is that what he meant? Or was there a principle involved? Did he literally mean to say that your eyeball is the problem in lust? Did he mean to say your right hand is the problem if you're a thief? So pluck out the eye and cut off your hand? You know that's not what Jesus meant. What he meant was, whatever stands between you and God, you need to get rid of it. You need to correct the problem. Even if it's something valuable to you. And I'm telling you, that's said in the context of lust. You know what? If you can't deal with those feelings with a friend of yours, you better cut off the relationship. It is not easy to remove ourselves from things that Satan can use. It may be money, it may be a house, it may be a person. And that's what Jesus is saying, is there's a principle here. No matter how valuable it is to you, if it's causing a problem in your relationship with God, you need to get rid of it. Jesus also says in the Sermon on the Mount, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing in chapter 6 and verse 3. Is that what he meant? Does he mean to put your money in the plate like this? So my left hand doesn't know what my right hand is doing? Does my left hand have a brain? Is it not my one brain controlling what my left and right hand do? In chapter 6 and verse 6, he says, shut your door and pray in secret. We've had public prayers here today. Did we violate the word of Jesus? Or did he mean something by go home, don't stand on the street corner, but go home and shut your door, get in your closet and pray in private? Jesus in chapter 6 and verse 19 said, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on the earth. Do you have a bank account? Do you have a savings account? Do you have a retirement fund? Are you violating what Jesus said? He said, do not lay up treasures. Is that what he meant? Was he teaching against bank accounts? Was he teaching against foreseeing issues that may arise and are needing to cover them? Or did he have a heart matter at issue? He said in chapter 7, verse 7, ask and seek and knock and it'll be opened. Does that mean you're going to get everything you ask for from God? Does it involve the attitude with which you ask things for God? Does it involve your intent of what you ask from God? But Jesus said, ask and seek and knock and it'll be yours. You see, this is common, brethren. This is common in the way Jesus teaches. He's got a focus. He's got a principle in mind. And sometimes he uses extreme language. Is Jesus teaching us that we can't defend our family? Is he teaching us that it's wrong to have an alarm system because we shouldn't resist the evil one? The lady that was just killed last week here in Atlanta by the carjacker? If somebody comes up to you in a parking lot and puts a gun in your back and says, get in the car and give me your car keys, should you get in? We tell our daughters not to. Scream, holler, kick, stomp, grab, yell. You do anything you can possibly do. Do not get in the car. Do not get in a trunk with anybody. Is that what Jesus is talking about? Or is he saying, in the context of what the Pharisees were doing in that day, is he saying, don't let yourself subtly be drawn into the mindset of treachery and vengeance and payback, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? It is much better for you to be an accommodating person. It may be that we do take the matter to court and the judge finds in favor of the other party. We were so sure of our position. We were so sure that we had the right. We were so sure it was going to go our way, and I'd sure like to hear a judge give it to him anyway. And so we let the matter go to court when we should have been peacemakers. Isn't that what he said earlier in the Beatitudes? Blessed are the peacemakers. Brethren, I hope I've been fair with this passage, but I don't think he's talking about defending yourself. I think he's talking about not becoming a bitter, vengeful person that goes around creating wrong under the pretense, well, the law said an eye for an eye. And in fact, let's go one step further with it. Now he just addresses outright your enemies. Not the man who wants to borrow, and so you lend. Now, at the end of this particular section, he's talking about those that are your avowed enemies. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. The law didn't teach that. The Pharisees had been teaching that. But I say to you, love your enemies and bless those who curse you and do good to those who hate you and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Look where Jesus now is trying to draw their minds. That you may be sons of your Father in heaven. And in our introductory lesson a couple of weeks back, we talked about this is where this phrase, your Father, begins to come out. It's in 545, 548, 6:1, 6:4, 6:6, 6:8, 6:9, 6:14, 15, 6:18 twice. Your Father, your Father, your Father, your Father. Why does he keep doing that? Because they don't know their Father anymore. This had just become religious exercise to them. It wasn't about God. It wasn't about Jehovah. It wasn't about honoring that relationship with Him. It was about finding a loophole through the law to allow me to do what I want to do. Give vent to my rage. Divorce my wife. Kill my enemy. And Jesus said, you know what? The real objective here is being like your Father in heaven. And your Father in heaven sends rain on the evil and the good, the just and the unjust, in verse 45. His Son, S-U-N, He makes to rise on the evil and the good. The real objective, and I think this is what Jesus is hammering on here, is to be like God. It's not even to follow law per se. Yes, being like God involves keeping His commandments. But the greater objective is to be like God. And this involves, and we should not treat this lightly, this involves doing good for those who are intent on doing evil to us. I think that's an overriding principle. Doing good to those who are trying to do evil to us. And this love is confusing sometimes because we equate it with some feeling. It is not a feeling. It is the settled determination of the mind to do for even this person that may hate me, to do for them what might get through to them about the nature of God and the purpose of their soul and their life here and their destiny. That I'm able to get past my bitterness, my defensiveness, my ego, and still see them for what they are. And we've said this already, but so many things that Jesus is saying here is against dehumanizing another human being. Even going back to calling someone a fool, which he talked about earlier, Reka, is not. We need to be so careful we don't dehumanize people, because if we do, we'll start treating them like they're not human. And this is nowhere more dangerous than our enemies. Those that have either harmed us or intend to do us harm, we might feel justified in getting them before they get us, or get them back once they've gotten us. And He said, here's the goal, to be like your Father in heaven. Therefore, in verse 48, you shall be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Let me ask you this question as we close. Is your life, has it sort of sunk into the pattern of following just the lowest common denominator? I mean, in the daily course of your life, what motivates you to speak to people a certain way or react to people in a certain way? I mean, is it possible that some of these mindsets that the Pharisees had fallen into might have come to characterize you? And no longer is it about doing good to my fellow man or treating my enemy right, but I just got to look out for myself. What I'm trying to say is, in this last statement of Jesus, He says, you shall be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. What does He mean? Well, I think in part what He means is we have a high calling in this life. We have high purposes in this life. And the purpose is not satisfied by sinking to the lowest common denominator behavior. He says even the tax collectors like people that like them. I mean, is that your life? Do you just kind of go through life doing what comes naturally? Well, what distinguishes you from an unbeliever then? Don't unbelievers just kind of do what comes natural? Like the people that like them and dislike the people that don't like them? What makes you different? What makes your life different? Can you say it's because I'm striving to be like God? That I'm striving to meet His standard? And you're not going to be perfect. This word means grown up and mature more than flawless. But nonetheless, that example of God is our goal. It's the image for which we're striving, to be like God. Knowing all the while, it's an ideal we'll never reach fully and ultimately. But as we stumble and as we fall and as we fail to reflect that image, God forgives. God is patient. God is gracious. But friends, the goal has to be there. And so we'll ask you to ask yourself, is that your goal? Is that your intent in this life? Can we help you in that? Can we help you establish that? Is your main focus and drive in life to be like God? To come to the Lord and submit to Him in faith and in obedience to the conditions of salvation? To become a child of God and from that point on have a new focus and a new purpose in life? It's a challenge. It's a great challenge. There's nothing naive or silly or
fluffy about being a Christian. It's tough. The standards are high. Are those the standards you want to meet in your life? Can we help you while we stand and sing?